outside the Macabre Theater, the chilly weekend before Halloween, and most of what's here is supposed to scare you. Creepy clowns jumping out of nowhere, werewolves flashing claws, and lots of unsupervised teenagers. But there's one thing to make you feel safe. Someone made a call. It's the Ghostbusters car. Joe Pace has decked this thing out with sound effects and props.
Step out of the vehicle.
We have the trap to catch the Slimers, the PK meter. We have the goggles, little strainer hat that went on top of the gatekeeper, a Geiger counter, vapor meters, and we have the containment system in the back.
Even a couple of TV screens. And what do they play?
Ghostbusters, mostly.
Joe Pace builds replicas of famous cars from movies. Not just the Ecto one from Ghostbusters, though that one is impressive and seasonally appropriate. He's also built the DeLorean from Back to the Future and the Shaggin' Wagon from Dumb and Dumber. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I have some questions for Joe Pace. He's with me in the studio. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. And thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I sort of wish we hadn't given you the instructions to turn your cell phone off because we heard your ringtone right before the show, and it is amazing.
Thanks. It gets my attention.
What, tell me about your ringtone.
It's just a high pitch, and it's like out of a scary movie. A lot of times, the different sound tones that I usually put on the phone, I can't hear if there's, like, as if I'm doing body work or in a place that's a little bit loud. And this one here, I can high pitch and then low, high pitch and low.
Yeah. So, okay, how did this all start with the replica cars?
Well, I've been doing work on cars since I was 9 years old. My family, my uncle had a speed shop, Tony Pace, Pace's Speed Shop on Independence Avenue. Started out in 1946 after the war. Him and my dad opened up a shop at 5th and Cherry and down by the market. And then in about 1951, they moved to Independence Avenue in Bales, and then they moved up the street in 1956. So when I was there, I was 9 years old. My uncle let me help him build Model A's, Model T's. I was the first and the youngest members of the Hard America Model A Club that we started here in Kansas City. I was 12 years old, and my uncle gave me my first car when I was 12 years old, a 1924 T Roadster pickup.
Wait, did you know how to drive at that age?
I didn't really know, but I learned, and I used to sneak out and drive down the alley and go around Lykins Park until one day I look over, and on the other side of the park, which is almost a block away, I see the police, and it's a one-way, so the police start coming around my way, so I went around the other way and ditched them in the alley, and that scared the heck out of me. But but I was even driving when I was 14 when I got the Model A. I'd go up and down my street, and my neighbors would call and tell my mom and dad, hey, your son's driving his car out in the street again, and I'm 14. So, and then by the time I turned 16, I got my mom's 56 Chevy and started fixing it up. So I had three cars before I was even old enough to drive, before 16. And they instilled working on cars and the love of cars in my heart, and the whole family loves cars, and so that's kind of where it started. And I started doing body work.
But what about the movie thing? I mean,
well, the movie thing. Then it came about a good friend of mine. I had my shop on Independence Avenue, Monroe, and he had Cotton's Video. His name was Joe Fasoni, and he used to rent the movies back then. You know, you go rent them, take them home, watch them, bring them back. And he came by one day, and he goes, you've got to look at the stuff I got. And I said, what do you got? He says, oh, I went down to Universal Studios downtown to get movies. The guy told me that there's something new coming out. There's a movie that's a time machine made out of a DeLorean with Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd and a bunch of other stars. He said they need a prop down at the Hyatt Regency for 2 days and two nights. And they wanted to know if I knew anybody that had a DeLorean. And he told them, yes, I do. And I said, well, we need something. Would he put it in there? And he asked, what did it look like? So they showed him a picture out of a magazine that they had. And he goes, he'll build that. And they, well, we won't pay him anything. He says, no, he'll do it for free.
So wait, they showed you a picture?
No, showed him, but then he showed me when he came.
But it was
came.
A picture of the DeLorean in the movie, in Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm. They gave him a trailer, which is what you see on TV to show you what the movie's going to be about. And that gave me some of the different colors and shapes and things that where they were located and all that. So I went off of that. And when I asked him, okay, they're not going to pay me. I don't want to drill a bunch of holes in my car. I just bought it the year before. It was a 1982 DeLorean, and I bought it in 84, so it was 2 years old. He goes, you can figure something out. I says, well, how much are they going to pay me? He says, nothing. And I said, how long do I have? He says, you got 3 weeks to have it built. And I said, there's no way. He says, yes, you can do it. So I worked and slept at my shop quite a bit to get that done, and I got it done. It went to the Hyatt Regency. Universal seen what I did in such a short time. They asked me, would you do promotions for us? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you're going to have to travel. So that's how it started.
Back up and tell me how the DeLorean in Back to the Future, what was different about that from just a DeLorean that is not supposed to be a time machine?
Okay, you know, DeLoreans are made out of a pure stainless steel. There's no metallic, it won't rust. And then in the movie, what they did is they took this car that was very unusual looking to make it into something that wasn't never seen before, which they put these boxes on the back that were basically where your jet it would come out of the back, and they put all kinds of wiring, gauges, you name it, sound effects, the whole works that were on this. A lot of this stuff was done with pyrotechnics where they actually did it onto the film. It really what didn't happen in real life and stuff.
Do I remember right? This might just be, as I'm playing this back in my head, I feel like the doors opened outwards.
Golden
I mean, like
doors. Yes.
Upwards instead of backwards.
Mm-hmm. They go straight up. You can park closer to cars. The door will open less than a foot. So it doesn't go out, it goes up. And they're very unusual. There was only one other car that actually had that, and that was Mercedes back in the 50s.
But so wait, the regular DeLorean really did that?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes.
And then there was that weird thing on the dashboard that had like a funnel shape on it, and it would light up.
Oh, you're talking about behind the seat. That's the flux capacitor.
The flux capacitor. Yep. Great, yep. Scott, Marty.
Can't,
yes.
Can't go into the future or back in time without having that flux capacitor.
No. And, you know, like, seriously, when you build these cars and actually see the movies, do lines from the movies just kind of go on repeat in your head? Because that is what's happening to me right now. I'm resisting the urge to say great, Scott, throughout this whole interview.
After a few years of doing this, this has been going on since 1985. My kids hated the movie because everywhere we went, we played the song or we played the movie. And every car show I did, and I have seen the movie so many times or heard the song or the words, and I'm almost getting to the point now where I can't remember them. I'm losing track of it. But yeah, it's amazing. I still love that movie. It's still one of my favorites.
But the car really is a character in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's the main driving part. I mean, everybody just...
Driving.
I drive down the street and I park to go, say, into one of the different businesses and stuff. And the people come out and they go, I can't believe I'm seeing this on the street. I can't believe this. You know, and how did you get here? Well, I drove it. You know.
Did the kids think you came out of the future?
And you'd think that kids would be the only ones. But even the adults say, does it fly? Does it go back in time?
Oh, man.
Yeah. So it's a very good conversation piece, if nothing else.
Do you enjoy the movies that have these sort of recognizable character cars? Is
yes.
that as someone who's been into cars since had three before you could drive them?
Right. You know, I guess I'm a little bit more over the top than most people. Most people would go get a picture and hang it on the wall or buy a model and build the model. That's kind of how I got started was when I was a younger age was building models. But I said, why not build the car? You know, now I've got this that I can drive around. Nobody else has got one, you know, and there are quite a few now. By the way, I am registered with Universal Studios. I am the first replica of Back to the Future ever built.
That's so cool.
So, and I have the copyrights. I can do anything I want with that car. I cannot get in trouble for it because I've worked for them.
The feeling of power must be incredible.
I just wish I could go back in time. That's the only thing I always wish is that I can maybe go back and straighten out some of the things. Of course, I don't want to win any races or win any money for off of it. I would just like to be able to see if I could straighten out my life and make things even better.
Aw, the car for Back to the Future, I mean, you were talking about this is the first one you did. Was there anything about that experience that really surprised you of what it just felt like to recreate something that was really like someone else's vision, but you made it your own and kind of got in the mind of that idea?
The right at the beginning, I didn't know if I could do it. You know, I could turn cars into different colors and change the bodies and all that, but I didn't know if I could make a replica that looked as close as I could. I mean, because for one, I only had 3 weeks. And if you stop and think about it, we didn't have Google back then. You know,
yeah,
so
no,
you can't just reference.
How to.
Exactly. So I had to do it the hard way. I did the best I could for the 3 weeks that I had to do it in. I was proud of it when I got done with it, but I added to it after that. I just kept going. And I could find places that showed a picture. Or I went and seen the movie 12 times. To give you an idea, to make sure after the movie came out, I started changing it and making it look more like the car. And even 2 years ago, I changed more that I got to be able to Google the back end where the back was and changed to make it look exactly like in the movie.
So what was Ghostbusters your next movie car after the DeLorean from Back to the Future?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
That came out in, actually, the Ghostbuster came out in 84, Back to the Future came out in 85, and after I did the Back to the Future, and I went down to, with my family, we went to Branson, and down there by the animal park, exotic animal park, I seen this 59 Cadillac sitting out in the field. And I thought, I went over and took pictures of it and everything, and I thought, you know, that'd be neat to build a Ghostbuster car. Well, 2 years later, in 1988, I decided, let's do the Ghostbuster car. I know where it's at. So we went down there and hauled it back. I paid $500 for the car. And I took it and got it sandblasted. And the guys that were working with me and that were working for me, it took us 11 months to build it into what it was. And we did a consumer electronics show, a SEMA show, in Las Vegas.
When you first saw Ghostbusters, I mean, before you knew that you were going to do this, did the car make an impression on you?
Oh, yeah.
Tell
Definitely.
Me about that. Tell me about watching Ghostbusters through your eyes.
I can't tell you how many times I've watched it. It's so funny. And there's
agree.
So many neat things that, you know, those guys, Dan Aykroyd and them, they were kind of over the top. They didn't care if it upset you or oh my God, I can't believe they did that. Those guys kind of just led the way for making something that would make you just laugh. I mean, it's amazing on the things that they did. I couldn't wait to make it. I wanted to make it as close as I could. But these cars, I make them my way. I don't just go by. Now, the DeLorean, I tried to make a little bit closer to what it was in the movie. You can't make it exactly like the one in the movie.
Why not?
That's copyright infringement.
Oh.
You can't call it that it's Back to the Future from the movie. You can't claim it is the one from the movie. According to lawyers and stuff, you make it close and you do what you want. Ghostbusters, it started out as Ghost Blasters because I put 102 speakers, 30 amps, 6,200 watts of sound. I also put 5 pounds of phosphorus in the paint, which made it glow in the dark. Even just
I kind of feel like the characters in that movie would really appreciate this.
Well, I had a little kid. This kid couldn't have been maybe, I don't know, 5, 6 years old. He come up to me at a trunk or treat a couple of nights ago at the church by my house. And he first walked up and he goes, "That's not Ghostbusters. It didn't have the green paint. It didn't have Slimer on the hood." And I'm going, I'm getting criticized by a 5-year-old here. And I told him, I says, "Well, my car glows in the dark. That's why it looks green. And at night you can write your name in the side or draw or and stuff like that." And he just kind of looked at me. I says, "Why didn't they do that?" You know, and I've got my big motor sticking out of the hood and all that. I just built it to make it my Ghostbuster car.
And when you drive around in this thing, you play the Ghostbusters music. I have gone past you in this car. I mean, I didn't know it was you. I had no idea who it was. And it just filled me with delight, like sudden, like just took me back to being a kid and watching this movie and just being really excited. Mm-hmm. And does it do that for you? Do you get a lot of crazy reactions from other people?
I can't even driving down the freeway, people are hanging out the door or out the window. I worry they're either going to drop their phone or fall out. But it really makes you feel good that people just go out of their way to get pictures and stuff. And usually everybody asks, is it right if I take a picture? Sure. You know, and yeah, it's great because it's kind of the reward that you get. And just like the Mutz Cuts van, the dog van that I built from Dumb and Dumber, that van, out of all the things I've built in my life, for some reason or another, carpet on a van to make it look like a dog, I wish I would have done it years ago. People have smiles on their faces every place I went. You could see people a half a block away with their phone out waiting for you to come down the street so they could take a picture. And it put smiles on every, no matter what your age was, you smiled. And it was amazing. Little kids all the way up to 80-year-old people knew what that was. They didn't ask, why did you have a carpet on a van? It just was a lot of, it's such a reward.
So but carpet on a van, I mean, I'm guessing you have to keep that one inside or
no.
Else you would like, I mean, doesn't it get really dirty?
Every time it got dirty, like say if I got caught driving in the rain and stuff, I just go to the car wash. You go to the car wash, wash it off, and then what you do is drive it on the freeway for a few miles, come back. It's kind of like a hair dryer, and you come back, and I park it underneath my carport. That way it won't get wet anymore, but it will air out, and it'll dry.
So if we could all just like drive our furniture around, we would clean our upholstery much more
easily. Put some wheels on your couch.
Are there, when you watch movies, do you generally notice the cars in a way that you think other people don't?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Tell me about some of your other favorite.
And I don't want to criticize. I just look at them and go, you should have done this, or you shouldn't have done that, or this would have looked better. But, I mean, everybody has their art. Everybody does what they – just like mine. Mine shouldn't have the motor sticking out of the hood, you know, but I wanted something that was – when people look at Ghostbuster cars, they go, that's Joe Pace's. You know, and there was no question about that that was my car. And I build it the way I think it should be done, not just to copy somebody else. I mean, I've got a chrome rear end underneath it. I've got all kinds of different, you know, stuff inside, along with the stereo system and stuff. So, and the two TVs. Yeah, the ones in the movie, my DeLorean has three TVs. And people go, well, they didn't have TVs. But no, when you see the car, you expect it to do something. And what's nice about the TVs, one on each door and one on the dash, kids can stand out there and watch the movie and then look at the car, then watch the movie and compare the car to the movie and actually say, I got to see this car today. You know, and that's what makes me feel good.
Do you, I mean, Joe, I have heard that you have dated someone who also builds replica cars? Did I make that up?
I'm not sure.
I heard that, but maybe it's not true.
I don't know about that. Dated somebody that I know a girl that I have dated, she's got a Bumblebee, if that's what you're talking about, from the movie Transformers.
That sounds close.
Yes. Yeah, we just got that about 2 months ago. And it's the 2010, like the one in the movie. It is one of the Bumblebees, like the one in the movie. And she's changing things to make it look like, you know, even the crystal ball, mirrored ball on the mirror, along with the Bumblebee air freshener. She's trying to make it look more like the one in the movie all the way around.
So do you think of yours? I mean, it's clear that you love cars, and it's clear that you love the cars from these movies. Do you think of yourself as someone who loves movies?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Not only love going to the drive-in and the movies, and then seeing it in your house, too. I mean, the privacy of your house. There's so many things. It's kind of like a walk in the park. Every time you go through the park, you see something different. A different bird, a different, you know, it's when you go places, you don't get to see everything. So when you watch the movie again, you see things you didn't see the first time. And, you know, and you can go into
detail.
And
when
you watch
it the 12th time, do you see things you didn't see the
11th
time?
I try to. I try and remember them. Yes. That I still have a long ways to go on stuff that needs to be done. It's just that it's been such a long journey for me doing all this. And I'm down to the point where I don't know if you knew it or not, but I sold the Mutz Cuts van about a month ago. I didn't want to, but the guy paid me $20,000 for it, and I didn't have anywhere near that because I did my own work. But I'm building another one. It just was way too much fun to drive. We could drive it anytime, anywhere, and have a lot of fun with it. And I'm going to build another one. But the car I really want to build is the Batmobile, the 1989 Michael Keaton's with the big fins and the turban in the back. That's the next car I want to put out on the streets.
Is there a detail that you're really excited about with that one? Something that you just are dying to...
It is so massive. It's like 22, 23 feet long. It's black. It's very, scary looking coming down the street. It's, I can't think of the word, but it's a haunted house treat. It's something that would draw people's attention coming out of the darkness with this black car that looks like one from the movie. Again, people are going to be excited to see it coming down the street.
Is there a favorite moment of yours? I want to go return to Back to the Future. Do you have a favorite moment in that movie that involves the DeLorean? Or a favorite line? Just,
you know, it's funny that the DeLorean, the movies that they made from it, you know, the past, the future, and then the way back in the horses and stuff days. Mine was the future. I love the idea of what's going to come next. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when you picked up the phone that if somebody was talking, you had to hang it up because we didn't have, it was, you know, there were party lines, the microwave, fax machines, and all these things that kids nowadays just take for granted. So this movie gave us things, and some of it even came true, hoverboards and things like that.
Well, Joe Pace, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joe Pace joined us from Pace's Body Shop this morning. And next, after the break, what is so fun about scaring people and being scared? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard and Boo. Today's Halloween. We're going to start our next discussion with a visit to one of the Metro's newest haunts in Bonner Springs. This one is scary, even for people who genuinely like being scared. KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez takes us there. And a warning, you are going to hear loud, sudden noises and occasional screaming.
It's easy to understand why this haunt is called Exiled. I drove about half an hour to get here, the last few miles down a dark, narrow road. There are no signs indicating I've arrived, just a truck blocking the road, showing me where to park. That's followed by a walk down a long gravel road until finally a gap in the trees opens up to the ticket booth.
Hi, how many?
Four.
Four? Okay, it's gonna be a total of $100.
Exiled promises I'll encounter a forest full of deranged freaks on its mile-long trail. But manager Kim Frost says there's another significance to the name.
Certain houses blacklisted our people from stuff they did when they were young and stupid, or when they went above and beyond and they said, okay, you can't work here, you can't scare them like that. I said, yeah, you're exiled from working there. We're exiled, come on. So now they all work with me.
Too scary for the other haunted houses? With a wry smile, Frost tells me what happens when people act too confident before they go in.
I'll put a bounty out on them. I'll tell my guys, you get them to quit, I'll pay you. And they will be crying halfway through.
With that knowledge in tow, I find a group eagerly waiting in line.
How many is in your guys' group?
Four.
Four? Four? Do you guys mind if I tag along with you guys
Come
and record?
On. Yeah.
All right.
That's Marcus and Diego. They love haunted houses, and they've dragged their friends Dijon and Maisha along. Dijon and Maisha are a couple. All four of them are around 19 or 20, and they live in Kansas City, Missouri. Unsure of how this whole thing might turn out, they ask that I only use their first names. When we get to the front of the line, a worker hands out little red LED lights. They're not much, just enough to keep us from tripping on the trail.
If at any point you see an animal of any kind, we don't have animal props. They are real. They are alive. This is their home. Please do not try and touch it.
Okay. Given the setting, we're about as scared of what already lives in the woods as we are of the actors who are there waiting for us.
We have coyotes, we have bobcats, we have possums, we have...
Why the hell are we here?
Marcus and Diego take the lead right off the bat, but Maisha, the first-timer, isn't so sure about this whole thing. Before we even get to the first scare, she's gathering reinforcements.
Lady, I don't know you, but can I hold you?
Of course, of course.
A creepy, demented clown comes out of nowhere and follows us for a few minutes, whispering in Maisha's ear and cackling alongside us. We're not even 10 minutes in, and this whole thing might just be too much for Dijon.
Oh, my heart! We ain't even had a quarter of a mile yet!
Come on, bro. You good, bro?
How you doing?
My heart hurts so bad.
As we continue our hike, things calm down for a while. But with every step, we worry that something else might jump out from the dark tree just ahead. Frost tells me that's all by design.
You have to build anticipation for the scares. You can't just see back to back to back. You have to have gaps. You have to have your actors be able to do 5, 6, 7 different things rather than the same thing over and over again.
One of those actors is Adam Fletcher. At over 6 feet tall and covered in animal furs and blood, the mere sight of him is enough to bring out the worst in people.
I've had people push their kids at me and run. I had a group of friends come through. They bought their tickets, saw me from 20 feet away, took off running around. One tripped the other one on purpose to leave them behind.
This group, though, stays unified. After each scare, they check on everyone to make sure they haven't gotten separated, even extending the same concern to me.
We're leaving a lady!
She's right here!
I'm right behind you.
They did, for the record, learn my name before we finished the hike. Maisha, Dijon, Marcus, and Diego all know the threats along this trail are fake, that none of the people in the woods will actually hurt them. But there are moments along the hike. Like when we were being chased by a crazed man wielding a chainsaw, that feel very real. And while those moments can bring out the worst in some people, they're bringing out the best in this crew.
I love you so much.
I love you too.
We reach the end after about 45 minutes, and Maisha has some advice for the people still waiting in line.
Hey, all y'all turn back!
That's a rave review for Halloween Heads and Haunted Houses.
And that story has earned Lisa Rodriguez a new nickname in the newsroom. She will henceforth be known as the Lady. We're back in the studio, and we want to know what is so great about scaring people and being scared. Not everyone's crazy about it, and I will include myself in that statement, but a lot of people are really into Halloween and horror movies and everything that's scary. So into it that they can't just go to a regular haunted house. They have to go for a super scary hike in the woods. If this description fits you, please explain at 816-235-2888. Kim Frost, the co-founder of Exiled, the terrifying place we just visited, is with us now. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
What is it like to hear someone else's take on this thing you've built?
Oh, I love it. It shows my guys are really doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they're having a great time at it, and they are making memories these people are going to have for the rest of their lives.
Can you explain, just if you had to give the short answer to the question of what is satisfying about scaring people, can you capture that?
Mostly, I mean, it's a major adrenaline rush. It makes us realize we can completely break from what we do on a daily basis, be a different person, different persona, and really affect someone's life. And you see the look on their faces, they're going to remember this. It's great.
We are also joined by a horror photographer, Joshua Hoffine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So can you describe, in your own words, what it is, the kinds of tableaus that you create through your photographs?
My photographs are narrative-based, and so they're sort of like stills from horror movies that don't exist. And we treat them very cinematically, where we build the sets and use practical special effects and stage them with children as opposed to, or juxtaposed against villains and monsters to sort of create the sensation that you're witnessing the worst part of a nightmare or a movie.
You know, what's interesting to me about that, I am very easily scared by scary movies, even if they're not that scary. Like, even if I can think about the plot and be like, that isn't that scary. And what it is images, that there will be an image that just kind of has a way of etching itself into your mind,
right,
and reappearing, like when you close your eyes and trying to go to sleep or something, and you're like, ah,
Yeah, there's a certain power to the medium that goes beyond what just reading or being told a scary story can do. An image has the ability to really get under the skin and hit the lizard part of your brain that bypasses narrative and meaning and straight to something visceral in response.
What is it that you like about evoking that kind of response in other human beings?
Well, there's definitely two sides of the coin. There's the pleasure in scaring people, and then for others, there's the pleasure in being scared. I'm kind of in both camps. I really enjoy horror films. I enjoy haunted houses. Halloween is my favorite. And so as a fan of the genre, I think that's what pulls a lot of people into participating. Like if you just love it so much that you kind of want to get more involved and start doing it yourself, that's certainly what led to the photographs. I just occurred to me one day that no one was really making horror photographs, even though as a medium standpoint, it had more power or more potential for horror than other visual mediums like painting or illustration, because it is so literal in its visual presentation. Like a movie, it's absolutely verbatim. You know, seeing is believing. And so
I'm looking at an image here of a little girl in pajamas on a bed with the blankets just a little ruffled, so it looks like maybe she's just crawled out from under the covers, and she's clutching a teddy bear, and you can see her the shadow that she and the bear are casting against this sort of flowery wallpaper. And then under the bed, there are these just giant hairy claws coming out from under the bed on this wood floor with blocks, playing blocks, toy blocks, scattered all over the place. Can you tell me about that image?
Well, the first photographs I made definitely went to the heart of certain archetypal childhood fears, things that everyone could relate to. The more cliched the fear, the more I could presume it was universal in nature and that everyone would relate to it. Unlike a movie where you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, there's no time component to photography. So if they know where they're at, they know what story they're involved in, you can kind of just jump right into the moment. And so even though everyone knew about the monster in the bed, I don't think anyone had ever seen a photograph of it before.
Yeah, because when you think about the monster under the bed, you're that little girl.
Yeah, definitely identifying with the child or the potential victim of the situation is part of the art form. Like making sure that you're anchored with, you know, the place to be scared rather than the place of being scaring.
Kim, for you, I mean, is that when Joshua is talking about the moment where this thing is happening, like you just jump right into it, I would think that would be pretty similar to the people who play the characters on your haunted hike.
Yeah, I've got guys, the minute their makeup's on and they're getting near their spot, I can walk up to them to ask them a question. They won't break that character. They are in that, they're waiting for their victims. And it's just, it's almost becomes nature to them.
If we weren't talking about acting or staging things, that would be such a creepy statement, though.
I mean, you can't help it. I mean, being scared, everybody loves it. The guys that do it, the day after we're done with season, they're like, okay, I'm dog tired. 20 minutes later, they're like, what am I adding to my character next year? And they're scaring people all year long when they're walking through stores. It's just part of their nature.
Do you remember your first scare, like your first time putting some thought into scaring someone and getting a certain kind of response and pulling it off?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I remember being a clown in a haunt and, you know, all in leather, corseted pigtails. And I looked at a guy, went to go up to his group to scare them. And he was like, no, take my girlfriend's hand. He let go of her, had me grab her. And I snuggled up next to her and talked to her in her ear. She realized I wasn't her boyfriend. Screamed, peed, and then ran, but she held my hand and took me through three rooms with her. It was just guttural reaction. We waited in that room until her pack caught up with her.
So what was, do you remember what that felt like to you?
Oh, I was still snarling and chuckling at her, but inside I'm laughing so hard that it was just unbelievable to me that someone could be that scared and take their tormentor with them.
When you say that you laughed, is there something funny about people being scared, especially when they're scared of nothing that's actually going to harm them?
Yeah. I mean, to most of us, we're pretty calm, normal, everyday people. And to realize we can affect someone that bad, it's like, oh, wow, it makes us chuckle to think you're scared of us. It's not just the character, it's us.
Do you think, is there something deeper, you think, going on for you in performing these kinds of characters and these kinds of moments, like the moment of just what Joshua called the lizard brain, like just the physical terror that isn't something that's scary because you've thought about it. It's scary because it's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different components to these type of scares and, you know, doing this work. And all of us really believe, you know, it's that adrenaline rush when you're scaring and when you're getting scared. But it makes you appreciate everything else later on in life because you realize, okay, I survived that. Everything else, it's cake. So you remember it.
That's definitely a huge part of it. But I also think that, you know, as children in Halloween, we kind of adopt the visage of the monster that scares us. It's a way of not just confronting it, but sort of adopting the power of what frightens us and, you know, taking that power on for ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of pleasure in cosplay outside of horror. But there's a definite power kick to being able to adopt the monster's visage and be the one that frightens.
If you have a story, if you can relate to what Joshua just said, call us up at 816-235-2888. You've still got just a little time left. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Newsflash, it is Halloween, and we are talking about scaring people and being scared, and what's really in it for us. I'm here with Kim Frost. She's the co-founder of Exiled, which is a haunted hike that is for the scary scarers who are so scary that regular haunted houses just won't cut it. And then we're also joined by Joshua Hoffein. He is a horror photographer. He stages that moment from the horror movie that is the absolute scariest, when everything's coming to a head. And Joshua, you were talking earlier about that you like to draw on the most cliched kind of moments from
right.
horror movies, because you think of that as, well, then it must be the most universal of our fears.
Well, that's the basic assumption. I think that we're all born with a certain set of hardwired fears. It's evolutionarily put into our system because fear is a natural defense mechanism. You respond to danger with a kind of fight or flight response where you either get away from it, you confront it. It's not the sole property of man. All species experience this. And so if you kind of just start paying attention to those very specific fears that you're familiar within yourself and that you notice in others, you can sort of draft a short but concise list of what you think would frighten everyone. And the monster in the bed, the monster in the closet are like the most obvious things that will come to mind.
Kim, for people who are professional scarers, you know, I have a story. I mean, I scare very easily. Like, a loud noise is sometimes enough. And so when I was a kid and a friend had a birthday party at a haunted house, I was worried because I knew that I was not haunted house material. So my mom coached me and she just told me, like, just tell yourself no matter what happens that these are just people in costumes. Mm-hmm. Just tell yourself that and you'll be fine. And so I went through the haunted house thinking to myself in my head, these are just people in costumes. These are just people in costumes. And I was fine until Freddy Krueger jumped out at me because I thought that Nightmare on Elm Street was the scariest thing in the world. So Freddy Krueger jumped out with a chainsaw and I shouted out loud, you're just a regular person in a costume, which totally killed it. Not for me, but for him. Like, that actor just stopped what he was doing and was like, fine, you know, walked off.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us, when we get kids that come in, we start to feel a little bit bad at times because they will cry hysterically. But you'll get the actors. I know a guy that used to play Krueger, and with kids go, you're not real. And it's like, touch me, yes, I am. And they'll bring their hand out, and the kids lose it. The adults lose it. It's just, you have to have that different thought process to go after them.
Huh. So you have to read the different quote-unquote victims to
yes.
know how to perform?
Yes. Every single person have a different little thing that sets off that fight or flight. And that's what you have to look at them and figure out and hit them with it.
But you have to figure that out fast.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like I said, you'll have someone, you'll come out snarling and growling and they'll turn and giggle at you. and you need to do something even creepier, or you need to entertain them to get them off balance because there's another hit coming.
Let's talk to Matt in Baldwin City. Hi, Matt.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, back in the 90s, I got into a series of really realistic costumes from movies with my son, who was very small at the time. And when he was about five, I dressed him as Edward Scissorhands and made him a very realistic outfit. And so we went to a haunted house that night, actually here in Baldwin City. And at one point, this guy leaps out with a chainsaw, and so my son must have a pretty healthy amygdala because he started to attack the guy with his scissor hand, and the guy just said, "Whoa, this is not for me." You know, it was like I didn't know what I was getting into here. You know, it was like a complete role reversal. Which, you know, and in defense of the industry, this guy was an amateur. He was just a volunteer dad, you know, who showed up with his chainsaw, you know, but it was kind of noteworthy in the history of my son's upbringing.
But do you think that your son was emboldened by his scissor hands?
You know, he really got into the character in a big way, and I wonder, that begs a larger question: do people come to your haunted houses in some sort of character that then interacts with your characters?
Does that ever happen, Kim?
Normally, we request not to have the costumes. And it's not just, you know, us being mean. It's we've had people that go to haunts to start trouble.
Oh.
And if they're in a costume, they may duck off from their friends and do something where they can injure another customer trying to scare them.
Oh, and then they would appear too much like they're on staff and they're supposed to be there. So you're kind of controlling that the scary things remain scary only up to a point.
Right. We know everybody that I've hired, that I've trained, I know they know their limits. They know how to protect the people. And if we've got someone walking around who decides to, like, swing a baseball bat and hits a customer, not only do I have to find the person, I have to convince them it's not my guys. It was a customer. So my customers don't get to bring weapons in, not full face masks. I don't mind the makeup and such because we don't do supernatural. So if they're coming in looking like a werewolf, we know it's not us.
This does bring up whether even for people who love being scared and really embrace every aspect of it, love scaring others, are there limits?
There are always limits. Some people, you can do multiple different things to them. And yes, you're going to get the fight or flight. You're going to get the scare swings and we'll duck out of the way. There are certain people you do the same thing to, and it sets to the limit where they're mad. It just bases on where people are from, how they process what's going on. So we have to worry and set things in a certain parameter.
Joshua, in photography, in horror photography, are there limits?
There are. Like there are in movies. You have your basic base of work that's fun horror, like Fright Night or Poltergeist or something that's sort of made for the mainstream to enjoy. But then you have deeper ends of the genre pool where it gets more and more savage and more difficult to forbear. Like Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer might be a classic example of a film that's impossible to enjoy because it's so harrowing and so upsetting. So you do have a certain number of films that just keep trying to push the limit on how far you can go. But you do have to face the fact that the further out you go, the smaller and smaller your audience becomes because you've gone too far for the mass audience.
Have you ever heard from someone who felt like you'd gone too far?
I have, mostly because I just involved children right off the bat.
Because so, children are your models.
The children are my models. They were actually my daughters for all those photographs, and that's where I started. But when they initially came out, there was no word of explanation that just said, real photographs, no Photoshop, real children, and people definitely reacted with concern. I have a folder of hate mail and concerned letters that, what are you doing with these children? That I had to start a behind-the-scenes blog just to show that the kids were in on it, that it was all fake, it was very cinematic, and that everyone was having a good time. But even with that, I learned very quickly images that touched upon anything that was too taboo definitely got a stronger reaction and a more negative reaction. One like, this isn't fun. This is going too far, which in a weird way for a horror artist or a haunter is kind of a good review. Like you're kind of bulletproof from people thinking you've gone too far. It's like, oh, really? Like I really got you then, because that's about an 8 on a 10-point scale.
So there's no part of you that's like upset by hearing that?
Oh, no. No, absolutely not.
It's hard for me to relate. I think like there are maybe like really two different kinds of people. Like
people who like this whole scary thing and people who are like, scared equals bad.
Yeah, I think I don't have this, you know, from a reliable source, but my guesstimate is about 20% of the population are horror fans. The monster kids, the people that come to horror conventions and are genuine enthusiasts, real horror nerds. It's about 1 out of 5. And it peaks in teen years because that's when you're really sort of confronting these issues and you want to sort of try yourself and be brave in front of your date or your friends. But as it peters out, you get to the people that just really love the iconography, the texture of horror films, the sort of contextualization and the intertextualization of horror films becomes a real source of pleasure and passion.
Can
and
you
the deeper you're
that?
Into it, the faker it becomes. Like you become more.
The deeper you're into it, the faker it becomes.
Definitely. Like you have people like Tom Savini or Rick Baker who are special effects artists that become rock stars in this community because, like a good magic trick being performed, you're applauding the showmanship of look at that kill or look at that monster. That's fantastic. And so you're hyper aware, you're meta aware of the artifice of it all in a way that a casual moviegoer, a casual horror fan, is much more easily overwhelmed by the filmic experience. Versus someone who's a veteran because it's all fake. You recognize faces, you recognize techniques, and the pleasure is the recognition.
Kim is nodding really enthusiastically here.
Yeah, a lot of us, once we have a few years in on this, we'll watch a horror movie and we're critiquing it going, oh, no, they should have come from about 2 feet over that way, or, oh, I know how that effect of makeup was done. And a lot of us, after a while, you can't get scared. We're so used to it.
Can you talk to me about just like a technique that might sound really to you just the most obvious and basic thing, but someone who has never deliberately scared someone else beyond just knocking on a door and saying trick or treat, like wouldn't get like just you see someone coming, you're plotting your scare. What are some of the things you think about?
We look at how much they're running their mouths. It's like, oh, I know there's someone behind that tree over there. I know there's someone here. You know, we watch the spread out packs. Our favorite.
Wait, the spread out packs.
The big macho guys are going to be in front going, I know it's, I'll keep everybody safe. We'll let them go by for about 2 or 3 steps and hit the people in the middle. And when he turns around to find out what's going on, our second hitter is behind him going after him because he never saw him coming.
So scaring him from behind, thinking he's already past the thing that's scary.
Right, because he realizes, oh, my friends are getting hit. They turns around and watches. As he turns around, I've got daddy who's 6'2" standing right next to him going, hi, honey. And he just drops and cries.
Is it always a he?
No. No, I mean, we've got girls who lose it. My favorite story just happened last night. Well, Sunday night. We hire a lot of very different kinds of people. We had 3 customers come in who I had to translate for because they were deaf. They came through and explained the rules, the process to them, and they went on their way. They come out just tears, and I think they're scared to death. And they finally stopped to explain how much fun they had. And I was like, well, what do you mean? That first clown, they're signing to me. And I'm like, yeah, I swear we heard her scream at us. And I'm like, honey, you're deaf. They said, yeah. And from that point on, because they went out of their way to go after them and saw them signing, knew they were deaf. You can't do the snarls and the growls. You have to be up in their face. They had a great time because we went that extra step to make sure they had fun. So my guys can look at something and go, nope, I'm going to change it this way or I need to change it that way based on who's coming through.
What does someone running their mouth tell you? I mean,
that they are chicken. They're trying to be, I'm macho, I'm going to survive this. And it's like, you know, horror movie rules apply. You're running your mouth, you're the first victim.
Joshua, are there horror movie rules that govern what you do? I mean, clearly, like, that's your inspiration. But is there a rule that you kind of, like, live by as a scarer with a camera?
Really just scare first, think about everything else second.
So you have to think with your lizard brain, just like the person who's getting scared will be.
Oh, yeah. Things. If you know what scares you, if you are a coward, you can do the work of scaring another.
Man, I would be kind of good at this.
I'm a huge coward. It's a definite leg up in this industry.
Our time is up. Joshua Hoffine, Kim Frost, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And I hope Halloween lives up to your wildest dreams.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you. You too. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you later today. And if you follow us on Twitter, we'll be posting our Ghost Stories episode from a couple Halloweens back for your listening enjoyment. Some of those stories are truly frightening, and our producer wove music into them in a beautiful way. If that's the kind of thing you're into, check it out. We are at KCUR CST. Tomorrow, we'll hold on to the season just a little longer with a conversation about Day of the Dead shrines. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from our intern, Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.